Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quincy connecting the light. Apologies for the late start due to technical difficulties, but I have my guests here waiting to speak with me and you. It's Mari Jones. She is an author, producer, screenwriter, speaker, researcher, radio host. That's probably enough for the moment. And as a best-selling author, we're mainly going to discuss her latest book, which is called This Book Is From the Future, A Journey Through Portals, Relativity, Wormholes, and Other Adventures in Time Travel. Sounds extremely interesting. Welcome to the program, Marie.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, let me just settle one thing. Are you Marie or Mari?
Marie.
You are Marie. Okay, fine. like to get the name right there.
Yeah, now, people call me Mary often. So.
Is it? Oh, yes. I'm not surprised. Now, I think you've been involved in 10 different books, and some you co-author with Laurie Flaxman. Is this latest one that you've co-authored?
Yes. This is a book about time travel, and Larry and I wrote this together. It was just released a few months ago, so it's our most current project.
Right. Very interesting. Are you both in your own ways, shall we say, something of experts or very well informed on time travel?
Well, the thing was, we were trying to figure out what to write on next. We were trying to think up, okay, what do we want to focus on for our next book? And it was actually our publisher, New Page Books, that came to us and said, you know, have you ever thought about writing a book about time travel? And, of course, we're both very fascinated by the subject, but we thought there were probably already too many books out. And when we looked, what we realized is that there really wasn't one book that was easy for the general audience to understand in terms of, like, the past, present, and future of time travel and different things about time, too, not just time travel, but how unusual and mysterious the subject of time itself is. So that's what inspired us to write this particular book.
Right. Now, obviously, you'd like to discuss that first and foremost, but we'll have time to take a look at some of the other books you've written.
Right.
Does your book contain reference to other people in the sense that I myself have read recently of Andrew Basiago, who was a time traveler, and also, of course, Barack Obama? Do they feature in your book at all?
We do have it. We have different chapters. What we did is we didn't want to just write about the hard science of time travel because there's not a whole lot out there. You know, we haven't achieved this yet, so everything is theoretical. But we also wanted to write a little bit about the pop culture, all the different TV shows and movies, etc.
Oh, yeah.
We also have a chapter on what we call time travel conspiracies. And
yes.
So we wrote about different conspiracies and urban legends and, you know, people that have claimed to have been involved in government time travel experimentation and, you know, just really wanted to present the readers with enough information where if they were fascinated by something, they could then go do more research on their own. So, yes, we do talk about DARPA and the different supposed government time travel experiments and we get into quite a few of those.
Okay. Now, I think there's quite a little bit on the net about time travel. Well, I suppose you wouldn't call it time travel, really, traveling to Mars, but certainly in the case of the one I've quoted, Andrew Basiago, he actually traveled back to certain events. Do you think that's realistic and possible? I mean, I tend to believe what he says, but what's your view about that?
Well, here's the thing. If you just look at where we are with scientific research today, with what is made public, it would be impossible. Because even the most brilliant theoretical physicists are saying we're still way too far from ever developing that kind of technology. But there's always that sense that the government is up to more than they let on or that, you know, there's this top secret research that goes on that is usually ahead of what anybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to to say that it's impossible because we don't know exactly what happened. We don't know if these people are telling the truth. We don't know if something happened to them that they're misinterpreting as physical time travel. Maybe it was a form of consciousness or mental time travel. So it's really impossible to say for sure. I tend to lean towards the theoretical physicists who say that we are nowhere near developing the technology because theoretically we still haven't figured out the right way to do it. But again, I keep the door open because I don't know for sure.
Mm. Well, I think if one allows for what is claimed to be behind it, and that is that they're using ET technology. In other words, they've been given
ideas
without having to develop them or research them themselves. So they've probably jumped a few generations or perhaps 100 years.
If you put that
on the plate, then it makes it all sound possible. So again, have you sort of found any evidence of that type of input into it?
Well, again, we don't know because what is being suggested is always talked about in terms of classified or top secret experimentation. And I've heard that the association of extraterrestrials with even the Roswell UFO crash from the 1940s, that the entities that were found were suggested to have been time travelers. And that's very well possible because even the most brilliant of physicists will tell you that if a civilization is advanced enough to figure out how to get here from another universe or some far point in our own universe, they'd have to have technology that was way, way ahead of ours. So that extraterrestrial influence very well could be possible. And there's so many people that think that aliens were responsible for some of the knowledge of ancient civilizations. You know, you have the ancient alien theory. So it's something that's very common that we think we might have been getting a little bit of help from above, so to speak.
Oh, yes. I certainly tend to agree with that myself. And
figured it out yet. But they to them it's probably as common as cell phones are now to us, which a couple hundred years ago you never would have imagined a cell phone. So it really isn't out of the realm of possibility.
Yes, I agree again with you. But, of course, when you look back at ancient history, and some of it's recorded on tablets, old transcripts, etc., you do get stories that seem to be very easily interpreted as meetings with extraterrestrials. The nature of the language they use, although it's not in accordance with what we would use today, seems very much to indicate that. Now, you must have, I guess, for your book, have gone back and maybe looked at some of these instances, like in India, where they refer to the Vimanas as the what we call UFOs today. So did you do any research in that direction?
We didn't go too far back in that direction. We went into the past of pop culture, but I will tell you that in some of the books that we've contributed to about ancient civilizations, and there definitely a lot of the iconography and the glyphs and the imagery, and as you said, a lot of the written tradition, the mythologies of many cultures, it definitely sounds like they're referring to entities from above. And I love the fact that the idea that they spoke of them as gods, because they didn't understand that these very powerful beings that had capabilities far beyond our own human capabilities, they looked to them as gods. And yet, maybe the word God really should have been replaced with extraterrestrial. So a lot of those stories, a lot of our mythology from different cultures, a lot of the imagery that we see with these beings that look like they're wearing helmets and they're hovering in these craft, all over the world. I mean, this stuff is so ancient, and if you replace the word gods from above with extraterrestrials, it sure seems to make a lot of sense. And in terms of time travelers, absolutely, because you think about where we were at a couple of thousand years ago, you know, very primitive in our technology. Mm. So we very well could have been being visited by other civilizations from the future, and again, coming to us with technology that they had figured out that was light years ahead of our own, so to speak. And I, you know, again, I think that we'll achieve that technology someday, because if you look back at where we were a few hundred years ago to where we are now with computer capability and processing capability, it is like magic. It would have looked the same. It would have looked like magic.
Yes, yes. And of course, you have the evidence within our own time of contact with ETs. Flying craft landing on the Earth and contacts being made from person to person. So it would seem, historically speaking, that perhaps these visitors have never been far away from us.
Right. They're always been going on, and there's no, you know, we don't have to say that we've been visited by the same culture or future civilization. I mean, we could be constantly being visited, just as we travel to different countries, you know, when we want to go on vacation or what have you. We're being visited throughout time by different extraterrestrial civilizations that have finally achieved the technology that allows them the means to come here. So in a sense, if you look back at the history of UFOs, sightings, and contact, and what the entities were reported like, it's interesting because there are some differences that we can look at as, there's also some commonalities, but it is sort of a progression that maybe we're not necessarily just being visited by one planet, you know, from one particular universe, but we're like a tourist spot.
Yes, indeed. And it's interesting, actually, because I gather that, speaking genetically, that the human genetic setup actually carries some genes which are not accredited to being human. In other words, there has been some cross-engineering between us and extraterrestrials. So that in itself would tell us a very big story about our association with extraterrestrials, perhaps thousands and thousands of years ago.
Exactly, that we have that genetic imprint, and we think of ourselves as being so human, quote unquote. And but everything else on this planet came from the stars, and we know that our particles, you know, were pretty much made from stardust, and so that wouldn't be far fetched at all. But it's funny because we get into that mentality of thinking of ourselves as separate and human and very self contained genetically, but we're not. So I think, you know, there may be some people that are made uncomfortable by the idea that we may have alien DNA, but, you know, to other people it would probably be very fascinating.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. And I was speaking to someone recently, and we were approaching this type of subject, and I said, where do you think you come from? And he said, the Earth. And I said, well, in actual fact, I said, there's no such person as an Earth being. I said, every person must have come from somewhere else. This is my own logic, you see.
Right.
And it really approaches what you've just said, that people don't think in terms of them having anything to do with any other form of life.
Exactly. It's that human arrogance. But it's also, too, not, I think, being able to wrap your mind around thinking that far back in the past, because, you know, we pretty much understand that life began here, probably came on asteroids and meteors, and it was definitely extraterrestrial in origin, you know, this very basic biological and chemical building blocks that ended up being humans came from somewhere else. So, but it's hard for people to think back that far. We're so focused on ourselves and our own little bubble world. So, and again, you know, that it's that sort of human arrogance that we have, that we're separate from other living things on the planet and we're genetically special and what have you. But I think that there's something very fascinating to think that, hey, I'm made of the same stuff as the stars out there. And, you know, my origin is out there in the universe, not here on the rock of Earth.
Yes, indeed. That's very true. And, of course, the whole issue is not helped by the fact that I think for a very, very long time, matters of this nature were very much sort of hidden away and kept undercover.
Right.
And we're not really, in a manner of speaking, allowed to know the truth of what people's findings are. And why they should cover up the truth, I cannot quite understand.
I have a problem with that, too. I feel like, well, either they know the truth and it's scary, so they don't want to scare us. They don't want anarchy and rioting. Or they don't know the truth and they don't want us to know that they don't know anything, because then it looks like our authority figures are dumb, are clueless.
Yes.
You know? So I'm not sure which one. I tend to sometimes think that they may not know that much more than we do. And in terms of people who research the subject of UFOs and ufology, you know, maybe the powers that be don't know that much more. And so there's a hesitance to admit that, that, hey, we're supposed to be in charge, but we don't really know what the heck is going on. But don't panic. I'm not sure that I buy into the idea that they're covering things up because it's sinister or negative or fearful. I think if we were going to be attacked by an alien civilization, they would have just done it.
Oh, yes, I agree. They would have done it many, many years before we developed our own technology to the point it is today.
Yeah.
It would have been easier to achieve a victory without a war.
Right. So they're either observing us the way we observe other cultures and animals in the wild, or, you know, they're friendly. or we just don't know. I mean, it really could be that the government, and when I say that, I mean the governments of all the countries of the world, not just the American government, but maybe we just don't know all that much. And I think it puts authority figures in a kind of a shaky position when they have to admit that to the public. Yeah, there's stuff flying around in the skies, and people are being contacted and even abducted, but we don't really know what's going on, you know?
I think they would like to get us to believe that, but when you read some of the claims or the evidence that they've already, at a government level, secret level, had contact with ETs and, if you like, exchange technologies and things like that, then you have to say they know far more than what we do.
Exactly. But I wish that they would apply some of that knowledge in ways that would help people.
Well,
it seems like, well, if they know something about their technology or how to not destroy the planet. So it just makes you wonder, what is that knowledge that they know that they won't tell us? What does it have to do with? Does it have to do with weapons? Does it have to do with, sophisticated ways of moving about the universe? What is it? Time travel? And why are they keeping it such a secret from the public? Because, again, like we just said, if there was a sinister reason for aliens to be here, I don't think they need to work with our government. I think they could just attack on their own. So I don't know. It's very frustrating to get different sides of the equation.
I think it's probably most of the things you've just mentioned. And it is claimed that some of the technologies have been released in a form that has helped us. But, of course, their main interest is in developing technologies for weaponry and the like.
Right.
And I think what is behind that is different countries trying to achieve or get well ahead in the race for advanced weaponry and possibly in the long term world control. So it's a power game, really, I think.
Yeah, and that's such a human thing, you know. When you could take technology and you could either do incredible good with it or incredible harm. And,
absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, it makes sense, too, that if they are intending to do good with this technology, they wouldn't cover it up. It's only when you're intending to do bad things that you cover something up, that you keep it in secret. That is the word, you know, the meaning behind the word conspiracy. So, yeah, I agree, and I think it's been very frustrating for researchers over the years to have to dig through all of the misinformation and the disinformation and the different stories, and what the government says, what people in the know, whistleblowers have come out and talked about, and just try to get some nugget of truth in all of that.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're speaking, of course, currently about one part of the whole subject, which is time travel. But what are your views about traveling into the future?
Well, it seems to be a lot easier, theoretically, than going into the past. And that's really because, I mean, we still aren't anywhere near understanding how to do any of this. But one of the things that comes up when you talk about traveling into the past is the fact that, you know, there's causality. We've got cause and effect. Things that have already happened, can you go back and tamper with them? Can you change them? Can you even just observe them without causing any kind of change? Because the act of observation may indeed change something structurally at the quantum level. So the paradoxes about going back into the past and somehow messing up the present and future are really what keeps theoretical physicists from really thinking that we could ever do it. We might someday technologically be able to do it, and the idea would be if it involves something like parallel universes or the multiverse, where you could go back in one universe and do something, but in another universe it wouldn't affect the present timeline. So again, that's all theoretical. Now, going into the future, you don't have to worry about that so much.
No, indeed.
But again, you know, the idea is that if there is a chain of cause and effect, even going into the future, you could be tampering with the timeline that the present is currently weaving together, so to speak. And this is the philosophical dilemma behind time travel, that even if we could technologically figure out how, do we have the moral and ethical right to tamper with the past and future timelines? Because if you tamper with one, you're tampering with many. Everything is interconnected. Our lives are not separate. We come into contact with so many people. So if I were to go back into my past and change something, it's not just going to affect my timeline. It will affect the timelines of everyone that I came into contact with from that point on. So that was fascinating for Larry and I to write about and talk about and think about, because we really hadn't thought about the ethics of time travel.
Right. Well, I certainly think that if they go back in time and alter something, my own feeling about it is that they create another timeline where the effects or the changes that they created then are within that timeline. I don't feel that they can alter what the timeline say that we're on. In other words, if they went back and eliminated, say, your parents, logically you wouldn't be here talking to me today.
Exactly. And that's the grandfather paradox, that, you know, you can't go back and kill your grandfather, because then you wouldn't be here in the present to complete your timeline. And I agree. The idea that there are other realities or other universes or other worlds that we can sort of that sort of bypass that paradox may allow for it. But again, it's interesting how these philosophical questions come up when even many physicists will say, like Stephen Hawking, for example, believes that there is something built in, just physically built into the laws of physics, that will not allow for time travel for that very reason, because you're tampering literally not just with time, but with space. You know, space-time is intertwined and enmeshed. So it very well could be that no matter how hard we try, something, some law, will just prevent us from ever being able to step out of our own very limited view of linear time, unfortunately.
Yes, I think there are laws or higher forces that do impose those sort of restrictions. But one of the, in a way, most amusing stories I heard about travelling into the future, again, comes back to someone I've read quite a bit about, Andrew Basiago. He went into the future and he was somewhere where there appeared to be some type of school or college. And he passed a group of young ladies who, in the future, recognised him. and they spoke to him, and they had a copy of a book he was going to write in the future. And they knew him and recognized him from his book, and yet he hadn't even written it yet.
That would be wonderful as a writer to be able to go and see, what should I work on next? What's going to be successful? And again, if you if we accept these wonderful theories of the multiverse, the idea is that you could be going into a potential future and coming back and not necessarily tampering with that potential future. It all comes down to having all these different choices, different universes, where one may get messed up because you did tamper with it, but the next one will be fine, and the next one will be fine. You know, each one has a different outcome based on potentiality. So I like to say that the multiverse theory is the sort of Band-Aid for all the time travel paradoxes, because it really does give us an out for all these complications of, well, because even if you go into your future and you see something, when you go back to your present timeline, you're going to behave differently based upon what you saw. So you are actually changing some things in your existing timeline based upon what you observed in the future. Mm. But there could be another universe where you don't do that. You just do what you normally would have done, and you may end up writing that book, or you may not. You may end up meeting those ladies, or you may not. So it's just a fascinating idea that we may exist in different realities, where each one we're doing something a little bit differently.
Yes, it's really mind-boggling to think that humans are really a lot more complicated than what we think they are.
Yes, we like to think that we're simple and everything is simple. But
yes, indeed.
But it's not.
Okay, now, in your book, this book is from the future, you talk about a journey through portals. Now, tell us a little bit about that aspect of the book.
Well, one of the most popular, I guess you could say, theories as to how we might be able to get from here to there, from past to the future, or even from one universe to another, is the idea of using a shortcut through time and space, which most people know by the word wormhole. And, you know, they sort of serve as a portal between one, not just one universe and another in terms of space, but one time frame and another. So in other words, there could be wormholes that take you from universe A to universe B, but there could also be wormholes that take you from the past to the present, from the present to the future, from the future to the past.
Yes.
So whether you want to call them stargates or portals or wormholes or bridges, we don't know that they exist. The idea would be that you would have a black hole at one end and what's called a white hole, which is simply another black hole, at the exit point. We know black holes exist, but we don't know that wormholes do. And if they did, we theoretically don't quite know yet how you would keep one stable enough to get something through. Because right now light can't even escape the gravitational damage of a black hole. So you see on science fiction movies and TV shows that they use these electromagnetic portals or wormholes. And that is a very valid theory, and that's what's so great about pop culture, is that in a lot of the stories and TV shows and movies, even though those ideas are purely imaginative, they're also in many times based on the science of the day. It may be theoretical, but these writers are still looking at, okay, well, what is the current science of the day that we could put into the Star Trek movie or what have you? Stargate, that's another great one. So they really are a popular traveling route if we can someday achieve the ability to go into parallel universes or go into other times. But again, right now, we don't know for sure that they exist.
I mean, there is a school of thought that believes black holes are, in fact, the entry points to another universe. Is that, in fact, what you were saying?
Exactly. And you would have a sort of tunnel between that black hole and the exit hole, which, you know, just for the sake of giving it some contrast, is referred to as a white hole. So it would look, you know, look like a funnel on either end with a very thin tube between, and that would be, you know, the opening, the entry point, and then the exit point. And the exit point could even be somewhere in our own universe, just, you know, at a vast distance away. But it could also exit in another universe, and it could also exit in another time. So it's just kind of interesting if we could prove that they exist, and most likely we would do that on a very small, probably quantum level first, and then prove that they exist on a grander scale, we still would have to figure out a way to keep them stable, to get something through them without destroying it. So there's all kinds of technological problems, but it's just a really fun theory because it is so popular in fiction and pop culture and movies, but it's also a real popular pet theory of theoretical physics.
I mean, does this, all this picture that you're painting here, does that come to the point where you believe that there isn't such a thing as, really, such a thing as time, or that it certainly isn't fixed?
Oh, it's not fixed. According to those that seem to know the most about it, it's fluid, it's malleable, it's almost like clay. The human brain is what perceives, or I should say the brain, perceives linear time, and yet on the quantum level, the subatomic level, and on the cosmic scale, way out there in the universe, there's no linear time. So we're the ones that are perceiving time as being like an arrow that shoots forward. It doesn't shoot backwards. And I think that that makes sense in terms of survival of the species, because you have to have a means by which you give your life functionality, by which you plan events, by which you put things in order. You know, otherwise it would be chaos of everything happening all at once. So I think it's very functional of the brain to do that, to perceive linear time. But yeah, I mean, we're constantly being told that that doesn't exist anywhere else. It doesn't exist on a cosmic or quantum scale. Everything happens at once. And that's so hard to wrap our minds around. Yet it does show you that we do, if we could figure out how, we could possibly have some control over time the way that we have a little bit of control over space.
Yes, that's an interesting point, talking of there being no time, because it figures very much in the higher spiritual teachings. They talk of their everything being in the now, which you just said.
Right, exactly. And that is so hard for humans to do, because we spend consciously so much of our time thinking about the past and worrying about the future that we very rarely stick to the present moment. And yet if you really think about it, those are mental gymnastics, because all you have is the present moment. And it is, the people that meditate talk about getting out of the linear time trap, and you know, it may not be for very long, but the experience of timelessness and being totally in the present. And I think that in many ways we do mentally time travel, whether it's in dreams or meditation or different types of spiritual practices, different paranormal experiences. I even think deja vu is a type of time travel, past life visions or regressions. I mean, I think there's different ways that we get little glimpses of how we go beyond linear time. But when it comes to day-to-day functioning, we're stuck in our bodies with these brains that just see everything as past, present, and future, and in that order.
Yes, you mentioned deja vu. It's a funny phenomenon, if that's the right word to use, because people doing quite ordinary day-to-day things suddenly find themselves, without realizing how it's happened, that they've moved back in time.
Right. Exactly.
They're seeing something that can be identified as historic, I mean, by the costumes people are wearing or other factors.
A location they can describe they've never been to, that existed in hundreds of thousands of years ago, what have you. Absolutely, yes. I think. And I like to think, and Larry and I wrote a book called The Deja Vu Enigma, and we looked at deja vu. We looked at all different kinds of anomalies of the mind. And we started with deja vu because it's so common. Everybody has had deja vu. And we do know the different parts of the brain involved. It can be triggered in a clinical setting. But what we don't know is why it happens, as you said, when you're just out of the blue, walking along, minding your own business. You might see a location, or you might have a conversation with someone, and suddenly you have deja vu. And I like to think, and this is becoming a popular theory, that deja vu is us getting a glimpse of ourselves in another universe and another timeline. And it's a very brief experience, but we are literally seeing or experiencing ourselves in another reality. And again, it could be another timeline, the past or the future.
Yes,
and I think that's a fascinating explanation for it.
Oh, yes. It really does help to explain that experience. And if I may mention, I read of one particular group of people, I think there was a husband and wife and maybe a friend, who were touring a part of France, and they suddenly came across this old-fashioned looking inn, and they decided to stop for a beer and a meal, and they went in, and everything seemed normal until they came to pay for it, and they were asked to pay a pittance for a fantastic meal. They began to realize that something was very wrong, and they eventually had the meal, they paid for it and left, and they had the feeling, I think we ought to go back and find it again. But of course, you know what I'm going to say, when they looked for it, it wasn't there.
It wasn't there. Uh-huh.
No. Weird, isn't
it? And those stories are so common. I've heard so many stories all over the world. I kind of like to call them time slips, where people just are driving along and they stop at a little cafe. It's very quaint. It looks very old, and they have a cup of coffee or what have you, and everybody seems to be dressed strangely. And then, you know, 2 days later, they're driving through the same area. The place is nowhere to be found, and they ask a local, and the local says, oh, that place hasn't been around for 100 years. And I just think that there are places where something happens, maybe environmentally, that allow us to sort of slip into another timeline. And you know, you wish you could make that happen voluntarily, but it just seems to happen to whoever and whenever, and you can't control it. But I have heard so many wonderful stories like that, and it's just fascinating to think that there are places all over the earth where you can slip in and out of our little time frame, the one that we're used to, our reality.
I think you're right when you, I believe you refer to it as a time warp, and quite clearly something's warped if you can walk out of this time into a different one.
And especially when there's more than one person present. If it just happens to one person, you could say, oh, they were tired or they imagined it. But when you've got two, three people or a group of people that all experience the same thing, then you have to take that seriously. You have to think, okay, there's something in that location, some anomaly that allows for this time, these time slips to be experienced, and not just by one person.
Yes, that's quite correct. Now, just moving on to something else related still to the same subject, did you gain any sort of information or otherwise from the Montauk Affair?
We did talk a little bit about that. We sort of, in the time travel conspiracy chapter, what we did is we led into it with the work of Tesla and how that sort of triggered the Philadelphia experiment and led into the Montauk chair and the Montauk project. And again, one of the most famous, I would say, time travel legends or conspiracies. You know, I sometimes hate to use that word because we really don't know what happened. And that all ties in as well to Andrew Bisaggio's story that there are specific devices, like the one of them was referred to as the Montauk chair,
yes,
where people actually sat in this device and there was a electromagnetic manipulation, which opened up sort of a hole below it that they dropped through and were taken into the past or the future. And that's absolutely fascinating because it reminds me of the movie Contact with Jodie Foster that was based on Carl Sagan's book of the same name, where she's in such a device and, you know, they're manipulating the EM field below her and the chair drops down and she ends up in a parallel universe. So obviously that science, quote-unquote, or that theory is something that is rooted in science. But, again, we don't know, I mean, did this really happen? There were other gentlemen. Andy Perro was another gentleman we refer to who claimed that he was involved with the device and was able to travel back into the future around World War II and get some information, do some observing. So we don't know. This is one of the, like the Bermuda Triangle and the Philadelphia Experiment and Roswell, these are the great legends that, you know, people still attach the word conspiracy to because we don't know all the facts of what happened. So much of it operated in secrecy.
Yes, it's a very, very fascinating subject, and I guess you could research it forever almost.
You could do a whole, well, there have been whole books on it, and we just touch on it, but absolutely, there's so much information. And then stories, you know, the stories as well from people who claim to have been involved with the projects.
Yes. I thought one of the sort of, again, a rather amusing account was given by Andrew Bisaggio when he spoke about literally getting into a lift, going up, as you might feel, a few floors. And when the lift opened, he found himself on Mars. And I thought that was wonderful.
Right. And then, yes, there was also the claim that they met a young Barack Obama, was also one of the chrononauts or the travelers that was being trained to go to, well, they called him jumpers. He was a Mars jumper. So you hear things and sometimes, you know, your first instinct is to think, oh, sure, I don't know about that. But, you know, these people have very detailed stories that they feel very passionate about and insist are true. And so it's hard to just say with 100% certainty that that did not happen. Or, you know, that you imagine that or something else may have happened. And when these stories persist, that kind of, you know, that the idea that where there's smoke, there's usually fire. So we have to keep that in mind.
Yeah. I thought the most interesting fact with Andrew was that he went back in time. And it was in a time when they were probably in the early stages of photography, and a photograph was taken, which he saw in this time, and lo and behold, there he was in the time that he travelled back to. So you have to look at that, and that really makes your hair curl.
Right, there's a lot of, yes, and there's other, you know, we call them time travel urban legends, where people have had other witnesses that said, I saw the photograph, or I saw this, or I saw this happen, or this person in this photograph was my grandfather. And, you know, you have witness backup as well, and that's really hard to just brush under the rug. So it's fascinating, and I imagine everybody has a piece of the truth. And I wonder if one day we're ever going to know everything, you know, if there ever will be disclosure of all of these conspiracies and what have you.
Well, I've got my own reasons for believing it, but I think we will know before next year is out. So I think a lot of things are in the offing right now, and they may perhaps turn up a lot quicker than we think. Now,
yeah, it definitely seems to be the disclosure is accelerating, and I think it's getting harder for anybody to keep information out of the public hands because of the internet and and everything just going viral. It's very hard to keep secrets, to keep information tucked away. No matter how compartmentalized it might be, there's always going to be somebody who talks and somebody who tells a little bit of their story, and then that just goes viral. So I think that it's getting harder and harder for secrets to be kept.
Yes, I agree absolutely with you on that. And there's so many people now, I think, prepared to stand up and be counted on the truth.
Yeah,
whereas perhaps 30, 40 years ago, people would be very reluctant to come forward and say anything.
Exactly. It was not something that you openly talked about, and yet you're right. Today, the public is very demanding of wanting the information, and if enough people want the information, then the powers that be, they're not going to be able to keep it secret. They're going to know. These people are going to look everywhere they can. We might as well give them the real answers. Because I think it can be very detrimental at some point when you have a public that is demanding the truth and you're still feeding them lies.
Yes. Now, I know you must have investigated the Philadelphia experiment. What did you make of that one?
That's another one where you've got people that claim they were on board, that they knew people who were on board, they knew some of the crew members. You've got people saying, no, that's been debunked. It was a simple degaussing experiment. It was done all the time. Or, oh, that ship wasn't even docked there at the time. You have constant, and this happened back in the 40s, and yet you have constant back and forth to this day between people who still insist that it happened and that it was a successful experiment in cloaking an object partially invisible or fully invisible, but also bumping it into the future a little bit. And then you have others that say, no, no, that never happened. It was a routine experiment. Nothing of the crazy sort ever happened. People misinterpreted what they saw. It's crazy. And again, I liken it to the Roswell crash and the Kennedy assassination. I mean, there are just these great events that it's amazing that here, you know, it's 2012 and we still don't really know what happened. And for a lot of the witnesses and people that were involved, they're, you know, they're passing away. A lot of the Roswell witnesses have died. And with them, probably a piece of the truth. So I imagine with the Philadelphia experiment, it's the same thing. The full story of what happened may not ever be known.
Yes, I think you're right there. Although, of course, when people have investigated these happenings, perhaps soon after the event, you do have the advantage of having the witnesses' statements, even if they passed on. So it does help.
Right. Right. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of time the witnesses wait. And I know if they're in the military or their government, you know, they wait till they're retired or maybe they have a deathbed confession. And that's, you wait all this time and then you finally get some of this witness testimony. And I know that was the case with some of the Roswell witnesses. But I have to say that today I don't think those things can happen as easily. If something like Roswell or the Philadelphia experiment occurred today, everybody has a cell phone with a camera and a video camera. You know, people are so aware of UFOs and unusual anomalies, and they're so hooked in on the internet that I don't think you could hide an event of that magnitude the way you could back in the 40s. So when something like that happens today, it would be very interesting to see how different you know, it would play out, because there's just no hiding anything now.
Absolutely. Now, you served some 15 years as a field investigator for MUFON, I gather, in Los Angeles and San Diego. Did you ever have any really good experiences that you might like to relate?
Oh, you know, unfortunately, I never saw a UFO up close, which was, you know, kind of sad. But I've met a lot of, when I was involved with MUFON, it was at the time when the abduction phenomenon was just really going public. And this was quite a while ago. And Bud Hopkins was working to try to train people in hypnotherapy for hypnotic regression and working to try to get those of us that were having people come to us with these abduction stories that we didn't know what to do with. We didn't have any way to really handle them. So what was really fascinating was seeing the beginning of that and talking to people who knew they'd had a very bizarre, often terrifying experience. And we were just at the dawn of really understanding what was going on. In terms of physical, there was only one time, and it was I was out driving around when I thought I saw something that I could not explain. And I had a lot of training. MUFON is, at the time, I think they're still that way, but at the time they were very, very strict and very wonderful about making sure you were trained to know what you were looking at in the sky. And I only saw one thing once that I couldn't explain. It was a very unusual object that was traveling sort of end over end. But it was at a distance, and I couldn't chase after it because it was going over a rural area of just nothing but hills. But other than that, really the unique experiences were meeting some of the very first real public abduction cases and just having that whole thing just snowball into this huge phenomenon that it became.
Yes, I mean, you mentioned Bud Hopkins. I think he did a fantastic job in getting to the bottom of abductions. Just a wonderful guy who had a very professional way, I think, of getting to the truth.
Right, and yes, very devoted. And again, there weren't a whole lot of people that knew what to do with those cases. So it was sort of a time when everyone was scrambling to, how do we deal with these people? How do we take the information there, who do we bring it to, and the whole reporting scenario had to change to accommodate these new types of contact cases. So it was really fascinating.
Absolutely, yes. Now, I've see your reputation has obviously preceded you in a lot of places because you appeared on History Channel's Nostradamus Effect series.
Right, and I'll be on the Ancient Aliens in a couple of upcoming episodes as well.
Oh, will you? That's interesting.
I have so many different books on so many different subjects that people, you know, they're bound to find me.
Now,
I can speak on a lot of different things.
When you say you'll be on Ancient Aliens, you're talking about the TV programs.
The TV show on the History Channel, yes. There'll be two shows. One is on prophecy, and I talk a little bit about different scientific ways that people might be accessing future information. The other program is on the power of the number three, which is a really fascinating idea for them, and how ancient civilizations all revered the number three. And if that has some ties into aliens and extraterrestrials. So those two episodes, I believe, will be coming up this new season.
That's interesting. I enjoyed them because there were so many good professional people on there saying their piece. And I thought, what a difference with a recent series like that
to what
they used to produce many, many years ago, because they were very biased. And they seem to have more people on who were, if you like, rejecting the ideas rather than finding evidence to support them.
Right, and there's so much evidence out there that you can't ignore it anymore. I think that's why that show is so hugely popular. It's really pointing the light on so much information that people, the experts knew, but again, because of the skeptics, it wasn't taken very seriously until now, and now it's taken very seriously.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously programs like that help to promote the idea of taking these things seriously, because you've got serious people on them, like yourself, of course.
Right, yeah, they have a lot of Egyptologists and archaeoastronomers, archaeologists, people that are religious experts talking about the iconography that it's just fascinating. Mythologists, you know, comparative religion. It brings together some very serious subject matter, very serious groups of people. So it's a great show.
Yes. I mean, you really are quite a person in yourself, in as much that you're not satisfied with all the things that I've mentioned so far. I see you also get in with the ghost hunters.
Well, if it's a mystery, I'll be around. I'll be involved. If there are questions surrounding it, and I just, yeah, I'm absolutely drawn to the unseen, the unknown, the sort of implicate side of reality. I think reality itself is fascinating, but I like what goes on beneath to try to figure out how it all works together.
Yes, I think if I wasn't me, I would be you.
I don't know. I'm really, really tired from writing too many books. I haven't had a vacation in years. But no, I love doing this, and I'm really, really blessed that people like to read what I write, you know?
Well, all of these things have fascinated me, I think, from when I was a teenager. I always remember when I was at school one day, and one of our teachers had been to Africa, and he'd been into one of these native huts, and they were involved in some sort of, I wouldn't call it voodoo exactly, but things were moving around of their own accord and so forth. And when he came back and told us about it, I was so fascinated by it. But the only thing was, and I bet I'm like you in this, I wanted to know how it was caused or what was behind it.
Yes, that's me. I want to know how it works.
Yes.
Show me the science behind it. I want to know how it works, like the mechanisms behind it, like taking apart a wristwatch or a clock and seeing what makes it tick. That's fascinating.
And I'd like to ask you, out of the other books that you've been involved in, have you got any particular sort of favorite that you'd like to mention?
I love all of them. I've written about so many different things. I think my absolute favorite is the first book that I did that was sort of my first big nonfiction book that was called Science, but it was spelled P-S-I-E-N-C-E, and it was about looking at quantum physics and new science, the science of consciousness, and seeing if some of that can be applied to explain paranormal phenomena. So it was one of the first books that really looked at the two worlds of science and the paranormal and brought them together. And the book did very well. It's still considered one of the definitive books to read if you're involved in the paranormal. And it was, for me, it was my first big book, and my agent and publisher took a big risk because I didn't have a name at that point, but that book really helped give me a name. I was on Coast to Coast. It was one of their most popular shows. I also wrote a book with my father. He passed away last year. He was a geophysicist, and we'd always wanted to write a book together. We wrote a book about supervolcanoes, and that was really just a wonderful experience to be able to write. My father, as a scientist, really influenced me from childhood on. I have such a huge love for science. So to be able to write a book with my dad that was a science book was really, really fun. But I love all of them. They're all so different.
Okay. And I'll mention that your father was geophysicist Dr. John M. Savino.
Right. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, you've mentioned that particular book, but I mean, very briefly, what was the catastrophic,
catastrophic event
that changed the course of human history?
We wanted to focus on the Toba super eruption that occurred about 75,000 years ago in Sumatra. The reason being, my dad had always been fascinated with that particular supervolcano because it literally decimated the human population at the time from about 100,000 individuals to about 2,000. And there's a little variation on it, maybe a little more than 2,000, which is, it's called a population bottleneck. And basically what happened is from that point on, everyone who was ever born was from that stock of 2,000 Homo sapien individuals. So it shifted our genetic history because of the people that died during the super eruption. You know, there was a lot more genetic variation that we could have had today. But because of that bottleneck, 2,000 individuals, maybe give or take a few, literally became the grandparents of who we are genetically today. And that has, that's a theory that has been pretty much proven as fact. So, and it, it, and we talked a little bit too about some of the threats today with Yellowstone, supervolcano, and one here near me called Long Valley, and what might happen. We even wrote a fictional scenario of what might happen if the Long Valley caldera were to super erupt, how devastating it would be. Not to scare people, but just to let them know that nature does what nature does. Yes. But it also, you know, can change us as human beings. A great catastrophic event like that can literally change who we are.
Yes. Now, 75,000 years ago, were we already the Homo sapiens species?
There were three species at the time. There was Homo sapiens sapien. There was Homo, Neanderthalus, and Homo floresiensis. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, which was a very unusual, there were midgets. They were very small, and there were very few of them living near Sumatra at the time. So when this occurred, it really did kind of get rid of, you know, those competing lines, and Homo sapiens sapien became the primary line of our genetic descent. So it's just, and these bottlenecks happen in nature all the time. They happen with different species. And in fact, some species go extinct. We were lucky because those remaining individuals, they bred like crazy and got the population to, what are we at now, almost 8 billion people.
Yes.
So
yes.
It really shows you how nature is self-protective and how very hard it is to drive a species to extinction, which I think makes it more of a tragedy when that does happen.
How did you find out about something that happened that long ago?
Well, as my dad was a geophysicist and also a seismologist, looking at the geological record, looking at core samples, sediment layering, and there's a lot of, and also we looked at the entire side of the genetic evidence that is available, the mitochondrial development, and so we put the two together. We've got the sort of geological evidence, and we've got the genetic evidence. We also included stories that have been handed down from generations and how these events showed up in different mythologies of cultures that sprang up once humans left Africa, so to speak. So there's actually, and there's a lot of geophysicists, seismologists, volcanologists who are aware of the Topa super eruption, and this theory really became strong within the last 15 years or so with the work of a lot of different people in those fields really contributing their ideas of, okay, here's when we think it happened, here's what we think happened, here's what happened genetically, here's what happened geologically, seismologically, also looking at the fact that there was a nuclear winter, a volcanic winter, same thing, that caused a mini ice age after that time, lasted about 6 years. So just looking at the earth for clues and tree rings and plant growth and different things like that, they were able to piece together something that far back. The last known super eruption was 25,000 years ago, and that was in New Zealand. So we've been lucky. We haven't had one in our modern history, and I hope we don't.
Indeed. Now, you have another book that mentions the zero-point grid. This idea of zero point is coming up quite frequently now because people are linking it with the outcome of what is referred to as the ascension point on the 21st of December. I have to think that you probably know quite a bit about that, but would you like to comment on it?
Well, I wrote a book called 2013, End of Days or New Beginning, where I presented all the different prophecies and predictions and scenarios that are related to the 2012. I like to call it enigma. The idea that we are the zero point field, and Larry and I refer to it as the grid because we like the imagery of a three-dimensional grid, is really a way to describe the most basic foundational element of reality. It's where everything comes from, everything will return to. It's a sort of ground state of energy, matter, form, what have you. So in terms of the ascension, I'm not sure how that relates, except that it will. There is what's called zero-point energy, which we are hoping may save us from the energies that we're using today that are destroying our planet. But I think also the idea that we're returning to the knowledge and understanding that there is this unified field, this unified ground state. We are all connected, literally interconnected. You know, what happens to me happens to you at the quantum level where this field exists. Everything is interconnected. There's no separation. Everything is vibratory. It's all about frequency and vibration. Nothing is solid. So I think those are concepts that we're beginning to really understand. They're scientific. They're also metaphysical, and they also have a lot of roots in religious belief, too. People have said that the kingdom of heaven referred to in the Judeo-Christianity could be the zero-point field or the zero-point grid.
That's an interesting thought. So what do you think of the period is likely to be following the 21st of December, because you've written in 2013, so presumably you've got some ideas of how things might work out.
Right, absolutely. And I looked at the origin of this phenomenon, and it really has a very minute origin, I guess you could say, because the references to a particular Mayan calendar, which was one of many that the Mayan civilization used, there was never any mention on their behalf that the world would end. And these are interpretations that were kind of placed upon their mythology over time, including the Judeo-Christian apocalyptic tradition, that it would be at the end of the world. And really, the Mayans were people who believed in cycles of nature. Everything went according to the stars and the planets and the way things grew around them. Everything was about cycles. So for them, their calendars were based on cycles, just as ours are. And the way our calendar each year ends on December 31st, it starts up again on January 1st of a new year. The Mayan long count calendar is said to do the same thing. It will reset at zero and begin again because it will be a new era, a new age, a new cycle. So, but there's been so much confusing misinterpretation, people with personal ideas about what they think is going to happen, that it's really, really hard to know to get to the truth. My feeling is there's a lot going on. We're accelerating towards a point with our technological development where we're about to lose our humanity if we're not careful. We are on the cusp of so many amazing discoveries, but we also have the ability to destroy our planet and ourselves with the press of a couple of buttons. I think it's a lot of things. I think a lot of people feel a push to evolve consciously, for the brain to evolve beyond three-dimensional capability. Maybe we will be pushed in a way that we can start seeing beyond linear time. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I do know just the realistic challenges that we have to deal with in the next couple of years, I think are going to stretch us quite a bit.
Yes, I think making the point that simply because the Mayan calendar ends at the end of this year doesn't mean that it is the end of the world. And as you rightly point out, the end is simply the beginning of another cycle.
Exactly. And they believe that there were different world ages and one followed the other. And it's very much like our zodiac sign, where we have specific ages. We're about to leave the age of Pisces and enter the age of Aquarius. But it doesn't end after that. It just keeps going. It's like a wheel. And their calendar round was shaped as a wheel. And it had different signs. And we're moving through those different signs. But there's no end point. In fact, there are edifices in throughout the Mayan region that point to dates far beyond 2012. So obviously, they believed we were gonna go on. This is just the end of one age and the beginning of another. Just as we're about to end one year and go into another, we recently in the year 2000 we ended one millennia and went into another one. So
yes.
I think that, you know, there's no reason to believe that that particular calendar was any different from any other calendar that they used or that anyone else uses.
Except, of course, there is some evidence, I believe, to show that on the 21st of the 12th, there is actually a very big alignment between our sun and the great central sun of the galaxy. And I think NASA have acknowledged this.
It's a visual event. The sun will appear from our perspective on Earth to pass through the equatorial midpoint the Milky Way. So for the Mayans, that was a very symbolic event because it gave the appearance of the sacred tree, if they were to look up in the sky and see that, although we have to ask how were they able to see without telescopes. Unless they had a little extraterrestrial help, did they know these events were going to occur so far in the future? That's what fascinates me. But a lot of people are, we're not going to move through the middle of the Milky Way, but the sun will appear to pass through the equatorial midpoint. So it's like an eclipse, or it's like when Mars, Venus, and Jupiter align. It's a very symbolic visual event. And, you know, we take from that what we can. These galactic alignments have occurred before. There are also what are called grand galactic alignments where several planets line up, but that happens very rarely. I think it's every 64 million years. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. And it's also the winter solstice, which was a very important day in their, their regard of natural cycles. Obviously, the equinoxes and solstices were critical days. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't know. Who knows?
Well.
But I have a feeling that, you know, nothing anybody should be afraid of. It'll be a day full of events all over the world, and hopefully most people will use it as a time to expand their consciousness and maybe raise their awareness. I would love to see that happen. And I don't think it's any doom and gloom is going to come from people who I think buy into the apocalyptic traditions.
Right. So, Marie, I was just commenting on what you said there, that I believe there is an expectation that this alignment between our sun and the great central sun will actually result in a great surge of energy that will come into our solar system. And you mentioned about perhaps our consciousness growing or expanding, and I think it's linked in with that energy. Would that make sense to you?
Well, on a scientific level, no, because the sun is so far from the midpoint of the Milky Way that there would be no influence at all. There's just absolutely no geomagnetic or electromagnetic influence. Again, I think it was a symbolic visual event. If anything, I think what people might be more aware of is the fact that there is an incredible amount of solar activity going on directed at the Earth at this point. We're coming up on a sort of a peak of a solar activity cycle, which will actually peak next year in late 2013. So we've had a lot of solar activity interrupting power grids and phone, cell phone stuff and what have you. Technology's been just a little bit disrupted by it. That's going to increase a little bit. But in terms of the alignment, there's just such a massive distance between the sun and the midpoint that there could be absolutely no influence whatsoever other than the one that is symbolic. But symbolic influence works on the subconscious. So that, you know, the idea that ancient civilizations knew the power of the subconscious, of archetypes, of symbolic imagery, and what that does to us, that's why we're such storytellers. I think that's probably more what the Mayans were talking about.
Well, it's certainly interesting to hear another point of view. There are plenty of points of view around. Now, I think one final book of yours I'll refer to and just ask you to make a few comments. You mentioned about the power of three. Now, why was it that the three was so revered and perhaps even worshipped?
Yes, the Trinity, people who are Roman Catholic or Christian know about the Trinity and the idea that the face of God or the persona of God is threefold. And what Larry and I found, we wanted to write this book because we had written another book called 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomenon, which talked about numbers and the mystery and profound nature of mathematics and numbers. There was just another wonderful article out in New Scientist magazine about how everything appears to be based upon numbers, all of reality, just absolutely mind-boggling. But what we found in our research is the number three comes up all the time, everywhere, in every religion, in every culture, in their origin stories, in their mythology, in fairy tales and folklore. And we found that the Trinity itself has been so misunderstood over time, even the Roman Catholics can't quite explain it. And what we found by looking at these other religious traditions and mythology and the other usages of the number three is that it refers to a process of creation, not a persona. It doesn't refer to the face of God. It refers to God and how God creates. And so the number three represents that process of creation. It's threefold. And it's very simple, but it's very complex when you get into the science behind it. You have a creator. You have creation, which is the physicality, the manifestation. And you have a specific act of creating. And those three elements make up the code of creation. So we wrote a book called The Trinity Secret, where we really delve into how that code works, what the different belief systems are that have identified this code. I mean, thousands of years ago, everybody had a trinity of their own, and how we use it as human beings when we create as well. So just the number three, it really resonates with so many people, because I think on a subconscious level, we understand that it is describing creation.
Yes, I mean, do you think there is a power in the number itself in the sense as numerology understands it?
I do. I think again, it's numbers are so profound for two reasons. One, because on a scientific level, you know, physics, it's all about numbers and mathematics and ratios, and everything can come down to a number. And I think that we were talking about extraterrestrials earlier. The language that any other civilization from another universe would speak to us would most likely be mathematics, because if they would have understood that same profound nature of measurement and ratio. On the other side, I think we recognize the power of numbers subconsciously. I think that when you look at things like crop circles or iconography, religious iconography, or the Egyptian or hieroglyphs, there's something inside of us that resonates to those images on a subconscious level, even though we may not understand what they mean consciously. And I think numbers do that as well. And numerology is the belief that there is a science behind each number and what it means, what that particular measurement means. So it's just absolutely fascinating. My dad told me when I was young that I should write a book about numbers, and I laughed and I said, I hate numbers, I hate math. And it ended up being just unbelievably fascinating.
Yeah. It's always one subject that I've had a bit of trouble in handling. I don't know why, but there you are. It is very fascinating. I think I've actually come to the end of my notes here. There's not much more I think I could find to ask you about. Mm-hmm. And it's been extremely fascinating talking with you. And you're very knowledgeable, to say the least. Now, is there anything perhaps that I haven't touched upon that you would like to add?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think we covered just about everything. Just for everybody to hang on for the next few weeks. It's going to be an interesting journey.
Right. Okay. Now, you obviously would like to give our listeners your website address, I would think.
Yes. Yes. People can find out more about my books and what I'm up to at www.mariedjones.com. And my website with Larry Flaxman for the work that we do together is www.paraexplorers.com, P-A-R-A-E-X-P-L-O-R-E-R-S, paraexplorers.com.
Right. I think we should point out there that the first part of your website, Murray D. Jones, is M-A-R-I-E, in case people
right.
don't get that one right.
Yes, not Mary.
Yes.
M-A-R-I-E. Thank you.
Right, well, I hope your book is very successful. It certainly deserves to be. If it contains anything near the type of information you've given me, it must be extremely absorbing, I would think, and very interesting.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We had fun writing it. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. How long has it been out?
It just came out a few months ago, so
right.
not that long. Yeah.
All right, okay. Well, thank you once again for coming onto the program. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, friends. As I often say, yet another very interesting guest with plenty to say and very knowledgeable. Next week, I've got Dawn Henderson coming on. She is an author, and her latest book is called Star Speak, and it contains messages of ascension, love, contact, and also more about our star brothers and sisters. So we're obviously going to talk about that. So thank you for being with me today, and I do hope you can make it next week. And who knows, by then, the 12th of the 12th will have passed by. What else might we have to talk about? Okay. Thank you, dear friends. God bless you all. Thank you very much.